You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN 91.9 FM. I'm Katie Frankowitz. Two members of Congress announced this week an investigation of the growing number of arrests of American citizens by immigration officials. The attorney for one Oregonian recently arrested hopes the inquiry leads to answers. Francisco Miranda, a Milwaukee resident born in California, was arrested and held for hours by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement earlier this month. His attorney, Michael Fuller, said they have not gotten a good explanation of what made ICE agents think Miranda was not a citizen. Fuller hopes the investigation will lead to answers. U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut and U.S. Representative Robert Garcia of California announced the investigation Monday. The inquiry comes after ProPublica reported immigration officials had arrested more than 170 American citizens since the second Trump administration began. U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley ended his marathon speech Wednesday afternoon after speaking for almost 23 hours. The Oregon Democrat held the Senate floor to protest President Donald Trump and what he sees as the administration's threats to democracy. A poster that read, quote, "Ring the alarm bells, authoritarianism is here now," was up for most of the time Merkley spoke.
Every time we hear Trump or his cabinet members saying, "I'm canceling that grant, I'm defunding that program," because it doesn't act consistent with the priorities of this administration, that's an authoritarian statement. And we are deep into this authoritarian crisis.
Merkley's speech fell just short of the record set by fellow Democratic Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey. Booker, who was also protesting Trump, spoke for about 25 hours and 5 minutes in April. The federal government shutdown passed the 3-week mark this week. On Wednesday, Washington state lawmakers argued about the best solution. From Seattle, Joshua McNichols has more.
Emily Randall represents the Olympic Peninsula in Congress. She says the shutdown is about health care. She's demanding the renewal of Obamacare benefits that will expire on January 1st without congressional action.
We already had expensive health care, and what this administration has done and what the Republicans in Congress have rubber stamped have been drastic, life-changing cuts to the programs that our neighbors across the state rely on.
But Republicans say Obamacare doesn't work. Michael Bumgardner represents parts of Spokane County.
The solution is not to borrow ever more money that our grandkids are going to have to pay back to pay for a broken and very expensive system that the Democrats created.
The benefits being discussed help keep health insurance costs down for people buying coverage on the open market. That's about 3% of the state population. I'm Joshua McNichols reporting.
There's a new effort afoot to pull eastern and rural Washington away from the progressive political pull of the Puget Sound region. Spokane Valley Republican State Representative Rob Chase proposes to create two autonomous political jurisdictions within the state. One would contain the counties that border Puget Sound and include the Olympic Peninsula. The other would include the counties in eastern Washington and those adjacent to the Columbia Gorge. Chase's bill is different than past bills that have sought to create a new state in eastern Washington. Those would have required congressional approval. He says this one wouldn't. He says the bill should appeal not only to people in ruby-red eastern Washington, but also to voters in the blue portions of the state whose tax receipts subsidize rural areas.
I call it win-win because they would get to keep their money, and we would get our own legislators. So we would actually have taxation with representation.
Chase's proposal would change the state constitution, so it would need two-thirds approval from the legislature and a two-thirds supermajority in a public vote. Chase held a town hall meeting in Spokane this week to explain the plan. He hopes to hold similar meetings in other parts of the state. Environmental groups in Oregon and Washington say a wildfire bill making its way through Congress could ramp up logging and cattle grazing on federal lands. OPB's April Ehrlich reports.
The Fix Our Forests Act would change how the nation prepares its land for fire, including national forests in Oregon and Washington. It calls for skipping environmental reviews for some land management projects, things like prescribed burns, logging, or cattle grazing, as long as they are under 10,000 acres. Environmental reviews analyze the way a project could harm the environment, and they give people a chance to weigh in. Oregon environmental attorney Susan Jane Brown worries about limiting public oversight.
The public's not going to be involved. Tribes aren't going to be involved. Communities, the state, counties will not be involved.
The Fix Our Forests Act also shortens how long people can take to challenge a project in court, from 6 years down to about 5 months. The bill now heads to the U.S. Senate for a full vote. I'm April Ehrlich reporting.
Oregon cities could more easily clear homeless camps under a ballot measure proposal backed by a prominent business group. Dirk Vanderhart reports.
The proposed measure would repeal a bill that passed the legislature in 2021. It blocks cities from enforcing anti-camping policies that are not, quote, objectively reasonable. At the time the law passed, federal court rulings already limited how cities in the western U.S. regulated street camping, but the Supreme Court tossed out those rulings last year. Cities and business interests have been working to undo the state law ever since, saying it ties officials' hands.
The current government response is not humane.
Portland attorney John DiLorenzo is a chief petitioner behind the proposed ballot measure. He teamed up with Salem Mayor Julie Hoy and Oregon Business and Industry, the state's largest business group. The campaign will need to collect roughly 117,000 signatures by July to land the proposal on the November 2026 ballot. DiLorenzo says he hopes lawmakers repeal the camping law before then. I'm Dirk Vanderhart reporting.
About 3% of Oregonians are waiting to find out whether their health insurance costs will go up dramatically next year. That's the share of people in the state who use the Affordable Care Act to buy private health insurance at a discount because they don't get health care from their employers. For that group, open enrollment, the time of year when people can sign up or switch plans, starts next week. But some of the government subsidies that make those private plans affordable will expire at the end of the year unless Republicans agree to extend them. That's an issue central to the ongoing government shutdown. Without those subsidies, people shopping for insurance for 2026 will see their costs go up by several hundred dollars a month, according to Oregon health officials. You're listening to news on KMUN. Oregon is the first state in the nation to be considered accessibility verified by a nonprofit for travelers with disabilities. Christian Fodenwenzel talked to a few tourists to find out why.
The Columbia Gorge Discovery Center in the Dalles shows visitors everything from how the pioneers rafted down the river to what indigenous populations were doing at the same time.
That might otherwise have gone to the Indians or have escaped to spawn.
There are movies and exhibits and a gift shop. It's a popular tourist spot, especially with cruise ship passengers sailing the Columbia. Cruiser Connie Robin lives in a retirement community in California and at 89 isn't sure how many more vacations she's got.
We decided we're taking this trip come hell or high water, so we're on it. Museums are not always easy to get into. This museum seems to have buttons on the door to open the heavy duty doors. And there are some people who are much more polite in Oregon than they are in California.
She appreciates that there are no stairways to navigate in this particular museum. She says new museums tend to be better than old museums for that kind of thing. And she likes it that the exhibits have wide aisles so she can easily push her walker through.
I think Oregon has been very good to people with disabilities.
Her travel companion, Janet McNeil, has osteoporosis and also needs a walker. She'll spend about $6,000 on this vacation, so she says making places accessible is not just about doing the right thing.
Considering the aging of the population and you want to attract more tourists, there could be money involved. I also think it's the right thing.
The nonprofit Wheel the World helps people with disabilities find accessible tourist spots, and it just designated Oregon as its first accessibility verified state. To win the designation, their members visited 750 spots around Oregon, measuring things like the number of wheelchair ramps, the height of toilets and hotel beds, how many disabled parking spaces were available, and the ease of getting outdoors.
Oregon, it has everything. You've got the ocean with the mountains, and you can have city or country, and it seems like it's all kind of right there.
Jennifer Allen is a travel writer for people with disabilities. She lives in Pennsylvania and is a member of Wheel the World. She also has a 9-year-old who is a wheelchair user, and they recently traveled to Oregon. She was thrilled with all the accessible activities here, especially Multnomah Falls. From experience at other outdoor spots, she did not assume it would be accessible.
I thought it would be pretty limited, like maybe we could, I don't know, get to a distant point where we could see it off in the trees, like from a parking lot or something. I did not realize there would be a ramp that goes up to the base where everybody else is able to view, which was fabulous.
That's where Oregon really stands out, says Allen, getting people with disabilities into the great outdoors, like Mount Hood.
We're in the forest and they have paved paths. Getting into the woods is not something we're very often able to do with a wheelchair user. Just the deep greens and the lush overhangings, I mean, it felt like we were in a fairy tale.
But it's not just Oregon's museums and iconic outdoor tourist spots that are more accessible than ever. At the Piakawa apple orchard near Hood River recently, Tom Schrader was pleased to see that mobility mats had been laid down in the fields so that he could get outside in his wheelchair without fear of getting stuck in the mud or tipping over.
You need to be in an environment where you feel safe. And just the slightest things can send you a twitter and a kimballing down a hill.
He says Oregon's coastal towns have also put out mobility mats, meaning that for the first time in years, he's been able to get out to the beach.
It just allows me to become more of the Oregonian that I grew up as.
The Oregon Tourism Commission says the new designation follows a coordinated statewide effort to improve access to tourism businesses, and that visitors can now plan their accessibility travel directly through the Travel Oregon website. Christian Foden-Wenzel, The Dalles.
You're listening to KMUN. Switching now to local news, at a special meeting on Wednesday, the Astoria City Council decided on the process for how they will appoint a new city councilor when current city councilor Vance Lump's resignation goes into effect November 1st. Lump announced in early October that he would need to resign because he could no longer afford housing in the ward he represents. Ward 4 covers the eastern side of Astoria and includes the Uppertown neighborhood where the Goonies house is located, as well as the Alderbrook neighborhood. At a meeting earlier this week, the city councilors voted unanimously to appoint a person to replace Lump rather than hold a special election early next year. They were concerned about both the cost of an election and leaving Ward 4 without a representative for an extended period of time. Now applications will be available to any interested candidates beginning on Friday. The applications will be due back to City Hall by November 1st. Anyone who wants to apply needs to be a resident of Ward 4 for at least the last 6 months. The City Council plans to prepare questions and make those available to the applicants by mid-November. On December 1st, the City Council will interview any candidates who apply during a public meeting. On Wednesday, the City Councilors decided that residents of Ward 4 should be given priority during a public comment period at that December 1st meeting. The City Council also hopes to hold a town hall in mid-November to give the general public a chance to meet the candidates. The tentative date for that is November 19th. Whoever the city council appoints will fill out the remainder of Lump's term, which runs through the end of 2028. In similar news, the Clatsop Community College Board is looking at two candidates to fill a vacancy after former board member Tim Lyman resigned abruptly last month. Matthias Lehman Winters reports.
Since his first election to the board in 2019, Lyman has been a vocal critic of aspects of college leadership and, at many times, his fellow board members. He resigned suddenly in early September over, quote, stupidity and incompetence on the board. Now, the board is considering applications from Napa School District Superintendent Bill Fritz and William Montero, a Seaside businessman and member of the Seaside Budget Committee. Fritz says his background in education and close partnerships with local schools would make him a strong fit, while Montero says his experience managing multi-million-dollar companies gives him a strong grasp of budgets and operations. Whoever is appointed will represent Zone 3, which covers the county's coastline from Hammond to Arch Cape. They would serve out the remainder of Lyman's term, which ends in 2027. The College Board will interview both candidates at a public meeting on October 29th. A final decision is expected on November 14th.
This story comes to us through a news partnership with The Historian. We're going to conclude the news portion of our show today with a special feature from the American Homefront Project. The Trump administration allowed the Pentagon to pay active duty troops last week despite the government shutdown, but that hasn't eased the concerns of many service members and their families who are anxious about paying their bills if the shutdown continues. Steve Walsh of the American Homefront Project reports from Norfolk.
Morley Proctor is the spouse of a sailor. She is stocking up at the food pantry inside Armed Services YMCA in Virginia Beach.
I got a few little breakfast items and a couple of canned goods and some rice and little pastas and stuff to kind of help fill the gap of what I don't have at the house right now.
The couple recently moved from Tennessee and their budget is tight. Her husband is still being paid so far, but that doesn't remove the anxiety the couple has been experiencing since the shutdown began. She's started delivering for DoorDash.
What I'm having to do to get out and supplement to make sure that we've got food and make sure that we have everything that we need, and wondering how we're getting our bills paid.
Some days the Y has to close the pantry early because they run out of food. Food insecurity has long been an issue, especially with young military families. Armed Services YMCA operates 22 food banks near installations around the country, serving 136,000 military-connected families annually. National spokesperson Doreen Ocam says there's been a 30% increase in demand since the shutdown began.
In Texas, there was a lady who was a week and a half away from giving birth who had to wait in line for an hour and a half because she was understandably concerned that she wasn't going to have the food that she needed after she had her babies.
During the Biden administration, spouses were encouraged to work for the federal government, including at local bases. Those civilian workers haven't been paid since the shutdown began. Don Cutler of the Navy Marine Corps Relief Society is encouraging troops to cut back in case future paychecks don't arrive on time and to stay away from high-interest payday loans.
Am I going to get evicted? Am I going to have my car repossessed? Can I put food on the table? Can I get to work? Those kinds of things are very real for our service members.
The group processed $317,000 in emergency bridge loans to 255 clients in just the week leading up to October 15th. The group provides financial management assistance, especially for junior enlisted sailors and Marines with families. Daniela Hines is a Navy spouse who works with the nonprofit Blue Star Families. Hines recently moved to Norfolk.
It is a critical time for military families. We're trying to adjust to our new communities. The cost of living is different from one community to another. Cost of the move, the loss of job for some, the loss of income for others.
She says the shutdown came just after PCS season, or permanent change of station. Each year, more than 400,000 military families move around the country or around the globe. Blue Star estimates families spend on average an extra $8,000 on moving expenses that are not picked up by the federal government.
The younger generation of military families have less than $3,000 in saving. That comprises 1/3 of the military families. All of this financial instability is really impactful for them and causing a lot of angst.
Congress has passed legislation to allow troops to be paid during previous shutdowns. Most of the military has never missed a paycheck, though the Coast Guard did during a year-end shutdown in 2018. The next paycheck is due at the end of the month. In Norfolk, Virginia, I'm Steve Walsh.
Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you through our news partners and by the KMUN news team. That includes host and producer Skylar Butenshin, news intern Sylvia Thorpe, and me, news director Katie Frankowitz. That's all for us today, and all for us this week. We'll see you again on Monday.